You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Aristotle and the Romantic Manifesto by Robert Mayhew.
With a couple of minor exceptions, Ayn Rand refers to Aristotle in the Romantic Manifesto only three times, twice to describe a shared principle of literary aesthetics, and once to describe Aristotle's cultural influence as it relates to Romanticism and Classicism. These passages are reproduced on the first page of the handout, which each of you should have, and these two topics are pretty much what I'll be discussing today. I want to begin with this shared principle of literary aesthetics, what I'll call the might-be and ought-to-be principle. And in particular, I want to begin with its appearance in The Goal of My Writing, which was originally written in 1963 and then appeared later in the Romantic Manifesto. Now, to understand this passage, we need first to go to The Fountainhead, which was published 20 years earlier in 43. There, Howard Rourke tells Stephen Mallory, quote, "I think you're the best sculptor we've got. I think it because your figures are not what men are, but what men could be and should be, because you've gone beyond the probable and made us see what is possible," unquote. In The Goal of My Writing, Ayn Rand says about this passage, quote, "I was consciously and deliberately stating the essential goal of my own work," unquote. And she goes on to say of Rourke's words to Mallory, and part of this is the first passage on the handout, quote, "This line will make it clear whose great philosophical principle I had accepted and was following and had been groping for long before I heard the name Aristotle. It was Aristotle who said that fiction is of greater philosophical importance than history because history represents things only as they are, while fiction represents them as they might be and ought to be," unquote. And note the quotation marks on those last few words. She refers to this might be and ought to be principle at least nine times, and not only in the Romantic Manifesto. Now, when I first read the Romantic Manifesto, which I think was about 35 years ago, I took this to refer only to characterization or subject matter, as the reference to sculpture might seem to imply. Good artists, or the better ones at any rate, present people as they should be, heroes and moral paradigms, not average people or depraved people, beautiful faces and bodies in the case of the visual arts, not average or ugly ones. And that is part of what she's referring to. But that's not the essence of it. In her Basic Principles of Literature, she writes, this is the second passage on the handout, quote, "The most important principle of the aesthetics of literature was formulated by Aristotle, who said that fiction is of greater philosophical importance than history because," and then she puts this in quotes again, "history represents things as they are, while fiction represents them as they might be and ought to be," unquote. And if you read on, it becomes clear that she believes this principle applies not simply or even primarily to characterization, but to plot as well, and likely to the other attributes of a novel too, theme and style. If a novel is good, she says, it is an indivisible sum of these four attributes. What I want to do is look at this principle as it appears in Aristotle's Poetics, and then compare that to what we find in Ayn Rand. And in passing, I want to vindicate Ayn Rand in that she is often criticized for clearly getting Aristotle wrong. Right. Now, part of the problem is that she did not encounter this principle from Aristotle directly. Right. As we've seen, she came up with it on her own. She said, "Long before I heard the name Aristotle," perhaps around the time that she decided to become a writer, which was at the age 9, I think she said. I assume she first heard the name Aristotle in any significant sense in high school or in college. Now, she first encounters this principle as coming from Aristotle, not in reading the Poetics itself, That's pretty much certain, and in fact, it's possible that she never read the Poetics. You can ask about that in the Q&A. Rather, she first encounters this as Aristotle's principle in Albert J. Nock's book, Memoirs of a Superfluous Man. That was published the same year as The Fountainhead, 1943. Nock writes, quote, "History, Aristotle says, represents things only as they are, while fiction represents them as they might be and ought to be. And therefore, of the two," he adds, "fiction is the more philosophical and the more highly serious," unquote. Now, in her copy of Nock's book, Ayn Rand underlined this passage and drew six perpendicular lines beside it in the margins. Ayn Rand drew straight lines as an indication of approval, and then she had squiggly lines or something if it was something she disliked. And she added the number of lines to suggest how much she liked it. In doing the Marginalia book, I don't think I ever encountered anything more than three lines. So six lines, she liked it. Now note that in a footnote to this passage, Nock writes, quote, "I hope I have not made too free with Aristotle's Greek in translating might be and ought to be, but I think the implication is certainly there," unquote. Now, I don't want to spend time on the Greek for obvious reasons, I think, but in a nutshell, I think he's basically right, and I indicate that in a note to the passage from Aristotle's Poetics, the relevant one, which I'll get to later. Or actually, right now. The passage presenting this principle appears in Aristotle's extended discussion of plot. The Greek word is mythos. It's where we get the word myth. It basically means story, but conceptually it's quite clear what he's talking about is what we would call plot, and particularly the plot of a tragic play. One of the four parts of a play, the others being characterization, reasoning, and diction, in that order of importance, but plot is the most important. Plot is the most important part of the play. He says that the plot should represent a single organic unity of an intelligible length with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that this is not achieved simply by focusing on one person, right, as some inferior writers of epic have done. And this is what he covers in Poetics chapters 7 and 8. And then Poetics 9 begins as follows, and this is on the second page, the top of the second page of your handout. Now, this is my translation, and I tried to get it close to the Greek. The Greek is in pretty wretched state. Quote, "It is obvious from what has been said that the function of the poet," and this is really a writer of fiction, "is not to present what has happened," or you could translate that what things are if you wanted to, but the closest would be what has happened, "but what sorts of things might happen," or you could translate that might be. "That is, what is possible according to probability or necessity. For the historian and the poet do not differ by presenting with meter or without meter." That would be a difference of in essentials, right? "But they differ in this. The one presents what has happened, the other what sorts of things might happen. And this is why poetry or fiction is more philosophical and more serious than history. For poetry presents the universals," takathalu, right? Poetry presents the universals more, history the particulars. And a universal is the sorts of things it goes with a sort of person to say or to do according to probability or necessity, which is what poetry aims at, though it attaches names, that is a concrete name, like Oedipus or what have you. While the particular is what Alcibiades did or what he experienced," unquote. So Aristotle then goes on to present various kinds of plot, some good and not some not so good. Now, before proceeding, I'd like to make what I think is an interesting point concerning the history of philosophy, or the history of philosophy of art, or aesthetics. Aristotle's conviction that literature is more philosophical than history is part of his response to Plato's conception and critique of representational or mimetic art, right? Which I think the poetics is in general, that I think a lot of what is motivating Aristotle's poetics is a response to Plato's critique of art, and particularly his view that art is not something, you know, is not something that we can have a rational understanding of or skill of. Okay. Now, in Republic, Book 10, Plato complains that representational art is twice removed from reality, from the forms, and therefore cannot convey anything true. All it can do is stoke the emotions, which are low and connected to the non-rational parts of the soul. I mean, physical objects, according to Plato, are already a copy of reality, of what is really real, the forms. And an artist, in painting a picture of a person or narrating a human action, is thus making a copy of a copy, right? So representational art is, in a sense, the opposite of philosophy. It goes in the opposite direction. For the mind of the philosopher moves away from the physical world, the world available to us through sense perception, and towards the forms. For Aristotle, however, representational art is not the mere copying of particulars. It is highly selective, dealing as it does with the essential features of human character and action, that is, with universal abstractions. I'm having trouble with the bottle. I think it was produced in Pisa. So, Ayn Rand speaks of what might be and ought to be, right? So Aristotle, if you translate it in the most straightforward way, it seems like might to be or might happen. But Ayn Rand, following Nock, speaks of what might be and ought to be. And she has in mind the need for the artist to present man as he should be. Now, is Ayn Rand in agreement with Aristotle here? That is, does Aristotle think that literature should present people as they ought to be? Now, in my note on Poetics 9, where I get into some of the Greek, and you can read that if you want to, on the handout, I make it clear that, in my view, the Greek translated might happen or might be can imply ought to happen, ought to be, right? But that's not the same as this being Aristotle's meaning. I think that has to be demonstrated. The answer to the question, does Aristotle think that literature should present people as they ought to be, is a qualified yes. Aristotle believes that the fiction writer should present universal types that act consistently or logically, and that this is required for the presentation of any type of character. The characters in a play will include villains and ordinary people, though arguably he thinks they should be larger than life. But setting aside comedy, which also treats universal types, and which Aristotle says presents people who are worse than those who exist, so comedy presents people who are lower than average, the main character of a tragedy or an epic, according to Aristotle, should be a hero, not reflecting people as they are, but in some sense people as they ought to be. And as we shall see shortly, this does not mean that such heroes must or should be ethically perfect paradigms. Aristotle recognized that not all poets present people in the same way, and poets here include tragic poets, Sophocles, Euripides, etc. They present people, he says, the way they are, or the way people think they are, or the way they ought to be. For example, quote, Sophocles said that he himself portrayed people as they should be, but Euripides portrayed them as they are, unquote. But Aristotle also has an opinion about which approach is best.
Quote,
since tragedy is an imitation or representation or mimesis of people better than we are, the tragic poet ought to imitate good portrait painters, for in rendering the particular form, while making people lifelike, they in fact paint them more beautiful than they are. So too, the tragic or epic poet, in imitating people who are irascible or lazy or possessing the other such traits, ought to make those who are such, that is irascible, lazy, etc., decent in their characters. For instance, Agathon and Homer made Achilles an example of harshness, unquote. The implication, of course, being that Achilles is a decent, you know, basically good character, certainly larger than life. All right. Writing about characterization in tragedy, Aristotle says, quote, first and foremost, the character should be respectable, unquote. And discussing epic, he writes, quote, it may be impossible that there are people like those Zeuxis painted, but it is better so, for the artist should improve on his model, unquote. So Ayn Rand's claim that according to Aristotle, history represents things only as they are, while fiction represents them as they might be and ought to be, is accurate. It fully captures the spirit of Aristotle's poetics, though she should, I think, left off the quotation marks, which are a result of her reliance on Knox's rendering of the Greek. I think it's closer to paraphrase than it is to a direct quote. Now, Aristotle does not make entirely clear, he does not elaborate on how the presentation of universal types rather than particulars contributes to the creation of proper plots, though it has something to do with not merely presenting concretes organized around one person or presenting a series of disconnected episodes, both of which have been attempted by inferior writers. Rather, all of the episodes of a story are organized by the fact that its characters are universal types whose actions and interactions follow from probability and necessity, as he puts it, that is, follow logically. But this is complicated, and I have nothing original to say about the subject. I would say, if you're interested in this, I would recommend Tora Buchman's essay, What Might Be and Ought to Be, Aristotle's Poetics and the Fountainhead, unquote. And that's, for more details, are mentioned on the handout. I want to point out another important similarity between Ayn Rand's aesthetics and the content of Poetics 9. The following passage from the Psychoepistemology of Art in the Romantic Manifesto has much in common with Aristotle's claims about literature and universals. Quote, it is very difficult to, this is Ayn Rand speaking, quote, it is very difficult to isolate and integrate human traits even into purely cognitive abstractions and to bear them all in mind when seeking to understand the men one meets. Now consider the figure of Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt. He is the concretization of an abstraction that covers an incalculable sum of observations and evaluations of an incalculable number of men of a certain type. Lewis has isolated their essential traits and has integrated them into the concrete form of a single character. And when you say of someone, he's a Babbitt, your appraisal includes in a single judgment the enormous total conveyed by that figure. Unquote. Now, here we see Ayn Rand going beyond and making clearer the already brilliant point Aristotle was making in Poetics 9 when he says that literature presents characters that are in some sense universals, though it attaches particular names to them. Literary characters are concretizations of abstractions with their essential traits integrated into the concrete form of a single character. And this, of course, reflects Ayn Rand's conception of the nature and purpose of art as a concretization of philosophy. For more on this subject, the key work, of course, is Ayn Rand's The Psychoepistemology of Art in the Romantic Manifesto. I'd also recommend the first section of Leonard Peikoff's chapter on art in OPAR, Art as a Concretization of metaphysics, and more recently, Harry Binswanger's The Objectivist Aesthetics, Art, and the Needs of a Conceptual Consciousness, which is in the Blackwell Companion to Ayn Rand, edited by Alan Gotthoff and Greg Salmeri. Now, it's important to keep in mind that Aristotle is describing tragic plays, right, as it existed in his day. Sorry, he's describing tragedy and epic, right, as it existed in his day. What their natures are and what makes them excellent or poor. He went on in the second book of the Poetics to discuss comedy and allied literary forms, but that book is lost, alas. Ayn Rand, however, is especially discussing the novel, and of more personal significance, the goal of her writing, which is not, and not necessarily, the goal of every author's writing. So what it means to present people as they ought to be is not precisely the same for Aristotle and for Ayn Rand. In the case of Aristotle, the words he uses to describe the good character, which I've translated decent and respectable, in passage quoted earlier, are not the most positive terms he could have used. He never says good, best, virtuous. Agathos, aristos, arete, if you know those terms. This is because the heroes in tragedy and epic must in some sense be flawed, as we saw, for instance, in the passage about Homer's Achilles. Further, it is hard to determine the aim of fiction according to Aristotle. I suspect it's in part didactic, but it's really difficult. I think it takes a lot of sophistication to make a distinction between the crucial importance to ethics of literature and the idea of literature as a morality play or didactic. I mean, Ayn Rand makes that distinction clear, I think, but whether Aristotle did or had such a distinction in mind is not at all clear. Ayn Rand, however, says that the goal of her writing is, quote, the presentation of an ideal man, quote, as an end in itself purely for the pleasure of the contemplation of such an ideal. One last issue before moving to my next topic, and actually this is a good transition to it, I think. The question, what is the relationship between the might-be and ought-to-be principle and romanticism? It's important to ask this question because, on the one hand, what Aristotle is discussing is emphatically not romanticism, right? I gave a course years ago called Aristotle, the Father of Romanticism. Alan Gotthelf, when he saw that title, said, shouldn't it be Aristotle, the Grandfather of Romanticism? And I think that's actually a better title, whatever. I don't think in the end it doesn't change the value of the content, in my view. I'm still on the one hand. On the one hand, Aristotle is emphatically not a romanticist. On the other, I get the impression that some objectivists regard the might-be and ought-to-be principle as the essential characteristic, in some cases the necessary and sufficient condition for claiming that a work of art, and not even necessarily a literary work, is romantic. Romantic on this view just means presenting man as he ought to be. If a painting, say, has a heroic man or a beautiful woman in an ecstatic pose, it's romantic. Now, what does Ayn Rand herself say on the subject? The best I've come up with, or best I've found, comes from material of hers published after her death, and so this doesn't count as official objectivism. Nevertheless, I think these are quite interesting and important passages. One of these concerns romantic literature, and the other, the idea of romanticism in the context of the visual arts, about which she said very little. Okay. Now, the first of these had been published in Objectively Speaking, Ayn Rand Interviewed. It was an interview on romantic literature, and she writes, quote, romantic literature accepts a formulation by Aristotle as its basic principle. The role of a fiction writer is to present things not as they are, but as they might be and ought to be. It is literature based on the idea that man has volition, and is able to direct the course of his life and achieve his values. It concerns itself primarily with the role of values. Romantic literature presents life in terms of man's pursuit of values and his dealing with value conflicts, not conflicts between a helpless creature, which is man, and some sorts of external forces. The formal expression of such an approach is plot, unquote. Now, when she speaks of conflicts between a helpless creature, which is man, and some sort of external forces, she certainly has in mind, at least in part, ancient Greek tragedy. And this explains her lack of interest in these works. So if you read the opening paragraph of the aesthetic vacuum of our age, she describes this. And she was also asked once in a question period, or in an interview, which of the great ancient Greek tragedians is closest to your view of life, you know, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and she said none of them, because they're too deterministic. She recognized that some of them present real heroic characters, but they're not in control of their own lives, and so it's very alien from her worldview. And she says somewhere, I've not been able to find the passage, that in fact this idea that there's a tragic flaw, that someone like Achilles has to be flawed, that's what creates the conflicts in ancient Greek drama or epic. That is not that you have different individuals with volitional control of their lives interacting, which creates the plots. No, it's these fairly deterministic beings who have flaws which create the conflict. All right. In any case, I think this allows us to better understand the passage I just quoted. The next passage, which is produced in Ayn Rand Answers. She was asked to elaborate on Leonard Peikoff's statement in his Philosophy of Objectivism course that it would be anachronistic to classify Greek sculpture as romantic. She replied, quote, "Romanticism is a 19th century art movement. It presupposed many philosophical ideas that were not available in Greek philosophy. Parts of Aristotle's aesthetics provided the foundation for romantic art." And I assume she means the might be and ought to be principle. But that's not all there is to romanticism. And it's completely inapplicable to Greece. Romantic art is always stylized. The better the art, the clearer and more attractive and intelligent the stylization. Greek art is not stylized. It's beautiful naturalism. It presents a slightly exaggerated, idealized human form. But there is no choice of values. All it has in common with romanticism is that it presents man at his best. They saw their gods in human form as the best possible to man, unquote. Now, this is her extemporaneous answer, or part of it. So let me add, and I hope I'm not being presumptuous here, or worse, wrong, that I assume that when she says there is no choice of values, she has in mind not just the choice of the human beings that are the subjects of the artwork, but especially the choice of values of the individual artist. This came up in the panel on art yesterday. Now, I'll start with the latter. I take it that she sees Greek statuary as not really or fully expressing an individual artist's choice of values versus an artist's presentation of the general Greek view that man is divine or what have you. And related to this is the fact, as she sees it, that Greek art, or definitely Greek literature at any rate, did not fully regard human beings as volitional, or did not regard them as fully or consistently volitional, as I've mentioned. And this is certainly the case with Greek literature. I don't know how this would translate into sculpture, and I won't speculate on that. And this is likely what she has in mind, though, when she immediately goes on to say, quote, "I don't like any ancient statues, except the Venus de Milo, and then technically, because she is so magnificently done." And then she goes on to explain why, and she pretty much repeats what she says about the Venus de Milo in the Romantic Manifesto. And she continues, "But that isn't enough for a sense of life approval. Ancient Greek statues of men are too beefy for my taste." I specifically mention why in my description of Galt's body in the torture scene. They are not active men, modern men, romantic men. Galt is, unquote. And you should go to that scene or that and see what she says there. One difficulty in understanding this comment is that Ayn Rand seems to be combining a comment about the aesthetics of visual art while also presenting her own personal aesthetic preferences. And so it's difficult, or at least I find it difficult, to separate them. So to understand or even to speculate about what exactly she has in mind here would take much more than I have, much more time than I have at present. And it's not like I have a lot of things to say about this, but I just don't have the time. It's a lot of difficult work, and I certainly haven't done it. The difference can't simply be that romantic sculpture would present man as active, whereas ancient Greek statues do not. Marianne Suarez, in her essay Metaphysics in Marble, which Ayn Rand specifically approves of, mentions positively in the Romantic Manifesto, contrasting ancient Egyptian sculpture and ancient Greek sculpture, makes precisely the point that the latter Egyptian sculpture, the latter ancient Greek sculpture projects action, whereas Egyptian sculpture does not. Greeks present action, whereas the Egyptian sculpture is kind of stilted. So it must have something to do with stylization, but I don't know enough, certainly enough about sculpture to elaborate on the subject more. And what one would have, this again came up in the panel yesterday, if one was really interested in identifying what exactly is romanticism in sculpture, you'd have to do what Ayn Rand did in literature. There is a historical period in the 19th century, mostly, where there were people who called themselves romantic sculptors, and they must have had something in common. But you'd have to sift through it and find out what precisely romanticism is. And that relates to the next passage I want to get to in a moment. One lesson to be learned here, I think, is that one has to be very careful applying the term romanticism as Ayn Rand formulated it, as opposed to just an historical designation as it's used by historians of art. You have to be very careful applying romanticism to the visual arts. Ayn Rand even said as much in another Q&A session. She was asked, quote, "Do the terms you apply to literature, realism, realism, naturalism, romanticism, apply to the visual arts as well?" Unquote. And she responded, quote, "The distinction seems semi-plausible, but it's the same confusion I encountered in literature, where there have been no firm definitions. I suspect it's chaos in painting as well. For instance, what is considered romanticism in painting, and I expect what she means is a lot of what is considered romanticism in painting, but that's my editorial insertion. What is considered romanticism in painting, I'd call rank naturalism. So I wouldn't claim that the classifications I've defined for literature hold for the other realms of art. Someone would have to establish that. All the arts, I'm assuming excepting literature, all the arts suffer from a lack of valid and objective aesthetics. There hasn't been any since Aristotle," unquote. So there's a lot of work to be done. The best work I'm aware of on this topic of romanticism in visual arts is Tora Buchmann's essay, Caspar David Friedrich and Visual Romanticism. And again, the details are mentioned on the handout. But doing this work isn't really necessary for evaluating or enjoying visual art. Ayn Rand had a great deal of respect for Vermeer, but you can't call his paintings romantic. Her favorite painting is Salvador Dali's Crucifixion, or it has a different title, which I never remember. But so far as I know, she never described it as romantic. Now, that would probably have a better claim to that designation. The point is, you don't need to, it's not a sense that art that is good has to be romantic in order for it to be, that's just not true at all. And Ayn Rand liked a lot of naturalism in literature. Maybe a lot isn't right, but she liked Sinclair Lewis, that's for sure. Okay, I've said something about the extent to which Ayn Rand saw Aristotle's aesthetics as connected to Romanticism. But she is a unique figure who sees things and makes connections others do not. So in what way do others think Aristotle's aesthetics exerted an influence in the modern era? Now, Ayn Rand discusses this as well. Here is the third long quote on page one of the handout. I'm going to be quoting sections of this, not all at once. And I don't know whether I'll quote all of it, but I'll begin at the beginning here. Quote, "Romanticism is a product of the 19th century, a largely subconscious result of two great influences, Aristotelianism, which liberated man by validating the power of his mind, and capitalism, which gave man's mind the freedom to translate ideas into practice. The second of these influences was itself the result of the first. But while the practical consequences of Aristotelianism were reaching man's daily existence, the theoretical influence was long since gone." And skipping a bit, "The 19th century was guided not by an Aristotelian philosophy, but by an Aristotelian sense of life. The artists of that century's great new school, the Romanticists, picked their sense of life out of the cultural atmosphere. It was an atmosphere of men intoxicated by the discovery of freedom, with all the ancient strongholds of tyranny, of church, state, monarchy, feudalism, crumbling around them, with unlimited roads opening in all directions and no barriers set to their newly unleashed energy. It was an atmosphere best expressed by that century's naive, exuberant, and tragically blind belief that human progress from here on was to be irresistible and automatic," unquote. Now, I can't, as part of one lecture, discuss the truth of Ayn Rand's controversial claim that Aristotle or Aristotelianism was the or a significant influence shaping the 19th century. That would require at least a couple of lectures on Aristotle's influence on the Renaissance. I actually gave a couple of lectures on this topic years ago, and they're available in the usual place. You know where that is. But such a discussion is unnecessary in the present context, because the point of mentioning this was to indicate that despite this influence, the culture did not explicitly embrace Aristotelianism in philosophical terms. And this includes the defenders of Romanticism. Their sense of life was Aristotelianism. That is, they held the view that the world is an intelligible place, the human mind is capable of understanding it, man is an excellent being who can achieve his values in his lifetime. But their explicit philosophy, including their explicit aesthetics, was not Aristotelian and often was anti-Aristotelianism. This had an unfortunate effect on the conscious convictions of the leaders of the Romantic movement. And Ayn Rand goes on to say, quote, "Aesthetically, the Romanticists were the great rebels and innovators of the 19th century. But in their conscious convictions, they were for the most part anti-Aristotelian and leaning toward a kind of wild, freewheeling mysticism. They did not see their rebellion in fundamental terms. They were rebelling in the name of the individual artist's freedom, not against determinism, but much more superficially against the aesthetic establishment of the time, against classicism," unquote. Now, part of their anti-Aristotelianism, as Ayn Rand goes on to mention in a passage I'll get to in a moment, involved their rejection of classicism. Because classicism was connected in the minds of its defenders and critics alike with Aristotle more than with anyone else, in the same way that scholastic pre-Copernican astronomy was and unfortunately still is often associated with Aristotle. Incidentally, for a brief illustration of both the conscious convictions and sense of life of the defenders of Romanticism, including their, as Ayn Rand puts it, exuberant and tragically blind belief that human progress was to be irresistible and automatic, I would offer this passage from Victor Hugo's preface to his play, Hernani. Hugo, by the way, had two prefaces that are really important for his view of Romanticism. There's the preface to Hernani, and then what is his Romantic Manifesto, the preface to Cromwell, and I'll have more to say about that later. But this is from his preface to Hernani. Quote, "Romanticism, so often ill-defined, is only, and this is its true definition if we look at it from its combative side, liberalism in literature. Liberty in literature is the offspring of liberty in politics. This principle of liberty is that of the age, and it will prevail. The ultras of all sorts, classical and monarchical, that is, classicism in literature, monarchy in politics, will in vain help each other to restore the old system, literary and social, broken to pieces. Now, after all the great things that our fathers have done, why should there not proceed a new poetic form out of the old, for a new people, new art?" Unquote. Now, here's Ayn Rand's description of classicism with a reference to Aristotle's connection to it. It's the last paragraph on the passage in the handout. Quote, "Classicism was a school that had devised a set of arbitrary, concretely detailed rules purporting to represent the final and absolute criteria of aesthetic value. In literature, these rules consisted of specific edicts loosely derived from the Greek and French tragedies, which prescribed every formal aspect of a play, such as the unity of time, place, and action, down to the number of acts and the number of verses permitted to a character in every act. Some of that stuff was based on Aristotle's aesthetics and can serve as an example of what, this is a brilliant line, of what happens when concrete-bound mentalities seeking to bypass the responsibility of thought attempt to transform abstract principles into concrete prescriptions and to replace creation with imitation," unquote. What I want to do in the time that remains is to flesh out this passage and make clear just how brilliant it is, or how dead on it is. And in the process, I hope to forever dissever Aristotle's soul from the soul of classicism, to paraphrase Edgar Allan Poe, right? At least in the minds of objectivists. Now, the influence of Aristotle's poetics on literature since the Renaissance is a story that one scholar calls, quote, "one of the strangest misunderstandings of a basic text in the history of ideas," unquote. And that's Bernard Weinberg's essay, From Aristotle to Pseudo-Aristotle. So I'm not claiming that I'm the first one to see this, or that even that Ayn Rand is, that there were some scholars who noticed that this was a distortion of Aristotle, what the classicists did with him. This history is very complex, and I can only touch on it here. I offer a lot more detail in my course, Aristotle, the Father of Romanticism. So unlike much of the rest of Aristotle's influence here, unlike much of the rest of Aristotle's corpus, the Poetics did not exert any influence in the medieval period. It was not rediscovered in the Latin West in the 12th and 13th centuries like the rest of his corpus. The Arabs had it, but they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know what the ancient Greek plays were. And they, in fact, the Arabs grouped it with his logical works, right? It was about languages. So it was practically unknown in the West until 1498, when a Latin translation of it appeared in Italy. A Greek text was published 10 years later in 1549. As I tell my students, you don't need to know the dates for the exam, so you know, don't worry about that. An influential Italian translation appeared around that time. In addition, several commentaries appeared in the 16th century, and these dates really mark the starting point of the influence of the Poetics on the West. When the Poetics arrived on the scene, what was the predominant theory of textual interpretation? That's an important question, because this is the answer is, in effect, part of the answer, I think, is likely a remnant of biblical exegesis. Two major points or aspects are worth mentioning here, both of which apply to the two major commentaries on the Poetics at the time, Rorbotello's and Casalvestro's. You don't have to worry about those names. First is what Weinberg calls fragmentation. And here is his description of this. Quote, "It was habitual among the commentators and the scholiasts of this early period to center their erudition and their labor about the isolated pieces or lines or passages of a text. Nowhere will there be any effort to state the meaning of the text as a whole. There is no synthesis to correct the fragmentation, no philosophical reading of the text. Since each line is, in a sense, torn from its context, it loses its status as a first principle, or as an intermediary statement, or as the final conclusion of a long process of deductive reasoning. The structure of a given document disappears. The form of the forest is lost, and only isolated trees remain for contemplation. This is perhaps the most striking characteristic of the commentators of the period. They see no text as a whole," unquote. This is disintegration, which will, of course, lead to massive out-of-context misinterpretation of Aristotle, which is what happened. Second, on top of fragmentation and related flaws in textual interpretation, there was a tendency to look for absolute rules or principles. Here, the tendency took the form of taking some of these out-of-context pseudo-Aristotelian principles as authoritative in literary matters, as rules, and so classicism is born. Scholars nowadays like to stress that these doctrines of the classicists were never as rigid as they have sometimes been portrayed. But this only means that there were exceptions and that there were genuine debates among the readers of the Poetics about these issues. But it nevertheless remains true that there was a real tendency at the time to take one's out-of-context or otherwise mistaken opinions about Aristotle's Poetics and elevate them to rigid rules of aesthetics. And when we move to the 16th century Italy, to 17th century France, which took the Italians as its point of departure in these matters, we see that behind this tendency was an idea whose time had come. As Emerson Marx puts it in the Poetics of Reason, quote, "In its stress on reason, order, and clarity, Boileau's Art Poétique," excuse my French, this is a French presentation of Aristotelian aesthetics, "Boileau's Art Poétique seemed a kind of literary counterpart to René Descartes' Discourse on Method. The critic's very addiction to prescriptive rules, answering neatly enough to the geometer's axioms, accorded with the pervasive mathematicism that Descartes' philosophy had engendered. Thomas Reimer's comparison of Aristotle's rules to those governing a triangle became a critical commonplace, still being echoed a century later by Gotthold Lessing in Germany. Rules, after all, imply order, and order more than anything else was the watchword of the age," unquote. So we have here this weird combination of disintegration and misintegration, to use the language of Leonard Peikoff's dim hypothesis. By 1630, but going back to the 16th century, certain literary rules were formed. Although there was never unanimity among the classicists about the exact nature and content of the rules, nor of their hierarchy, there was general agreement. The most important of these rules were the three unities, right? That is, the unity of time, place, and action. And these are all a pale and distorted reflection of Aristotle at best. We'll begin with the unity of time. This is the idea that the events of a play must take place within some set period of time, usually a day. Now, there are three passages in Aristotle's Poetics that led later thinkers to claim that he advocated such a rule, and once they were ripped out of context. Now, only the first of these has any kind of plausibility at all, the first of these passages. Now, I'm going to quote these three passages and discuss them. These are either the translation of Richard Janco or my own translation or some mix of them. The first is from chapter 5 of the Poetics. Quote, "With respect to length, tragedy attempts, as far as possible, to keep within one revolution of the sun or to exceed this a little. But epic is unbounded in time, quote, unquote. This is description, not prescription. It's an observation of general Greek practice, which Aristotle may have thought was for the most part a good idea or necessary, given the difference between tragedy and epic. I mean, tragedy was presented in a festival competition, and there was a limitation on time. But it's hardly a rule. And what's interesting, to see how some of these classicists worked, the passage that I translated, I think, accurately, tragedy attempts, some of the French classicists translated it tragedy must. You can have to be careful of translators. You can do a lot by massaging the text. Second passage, quote, it's from chapter 26, quote, "Tragedy has the advantage over epic in that the end or goal, the telos of the representation, is in a smaller length. What is more concentrated is more pleasurable than what is diluted with a lot of time and performance. I mean, for example, the effect if someone put Sophocles' Oedipus into as many epic verses as the Iliad." Now, this is, unquote, this is true enough, but it's hardly the status of a rule. Here's the third. As for the limit on their time, one limit relates to performance and the perception of them, not to the art itself. If the performance of 100 tragedies were required at one tragic competition, they would be performed against the clock, as the saying goes, unquote. Now, this does not even refer to the events of the play, but it's to its performance in Athens, where plays were presented in competition at a festival. And Aristotle's concern here is the audience's ability to hold the entire story in mind during one performance. So it cannot be used as evidence that Aristotle endorsed a rule for the unity of time. Moreover, Aristotle immediately goes on to say, quote, "But as far as the limit according to the nature of the thing itself, the larger the plot is, the finer it is because of its magnitude, as long as the whole is clear," unquote. Now next, the unity of place. This is the idea that in a play, all of the action must occur in one place: Thebes, Paris, Caesar's tent, the queen's bedroom, whatever. As one scholar puts it, this rule is, quote, "not even hinted at in Aristotle," unquote. As far as I've been able to determine, Castelvetro, one of these Italian Renaissance commentators, was the first to mention it, and he deduced it from the unity of time. Right? Finally, there is the unity of action. That's the unity of plot. This is in Aristotle. Right? It is his primary literary concern. Plot, he says, is the most important part of a play. A literary work must have such unity if it is to be good. In that sense, it is, well, I wouldn't call it a rule, but it's a principle. Yet it was hardly a straitjacket, and to the extent it was followed, the results were good. Now, here I would like to introduce Victor Hugo on the three unities. This is one of the many, many marvelous passages in his, as I put it, Romantic Manifesto, the preface to his play, Cromwell. Hugo rejects the rules known as the unity of place and the unity of time, which he calls, interestingly, quote, "that fundamental law of the pseudo-Aristotelian code," unquote. But he does not reject the unity of action, which he calls the unity of plot. Quote, "Unity of time rests on no firmer ground than unity of place. A plot forcibly confined within 24 hours is as absurd as one confined within a peristyle." That's the rows of columns surrounding a building. Every plot has its proper duration as well as its appropriate place. Think of administering the same dose of time to all events, of applying the same measure to everything. You would laugh at a cobbler who should attempt to put the same shoe on every foot. To cross unity of time and unity of place like the bars of a cage, and pedantically to introduce therein, in the name of Aristotle, all the deeds, all the actions, all the figures which Providence sets before us in such vast numbers in real life, to proceed thus is to mutilate men and things, to cause history to make wry faces. Let us say, rather, that everything will die in the operation, and so the dogmatic mutilators reach their ordinary result. What was alive in the Chronicles is dead in tragedy. That is why the cage of the unities often contains only a skeleton. A final argument would of itself suffice to show the absurdity of the rule of the two unities. It is the existence of the third unity, unity of plot, the only one that is universally admitted, because it results from a fact. Neither the human eye nor the human mind can grasp more than one ensemble at one time. This one is as essential as the other two are useless. Unquote. And note that some classicists even switch the priority of the rules, making the unity of action less important than the unity of the other two, or than the unity of time and place. There were also strict rules about the characters, tone, issues, moral propriety, and endings of comedies and of tragedies. Now, there are grounds, I think, for concluding that Aristotle would have disapproved of some of the things that appear in romantic literature on the ground of propriety. He seems to respect the fact that ancient Greek tragedies were very clean. You didn't do nasty stuff on the stage. Usually, well, Euripides started breaking some rules there. There's the head of Pentheus appears in the Bacchae. But I think he would have objected to some things. Versus someone like Victor Hugo, the romanticist, I think he was certainly thumbing his nose at the classicist critics when he had his hero, Jean Valjean, in a sewer, up to his neck in merde, and he made this an act of sublime heroic grandeur. You know, you want to break the rules? Here, I'm going to break the rules in a major way. I have a guy up to neck in merde. Which the classicists would, you can imagine, sniff their nose at. Right. But that's Hugo. So if I had to guess, I would say that Aristotle would have been closer to the classicists than to Hugo on such an issue. But this isn't really important, and there's really no way of comparing these things. It's not necessary either. There was an important rule about probability, which was supposedly based on Aristotle's view that in literature, one event follows from another with probability or necessity, and that literature presents not what has happened, but what might happen. And this is yet another example of what Ayn Rand has in mind in describing what happens when concrete-bound mentalities seeking to bypass the responsibility of thought attempt to transform abstract principles into concrete prescriptions, unquote. Here, the classicists turn Aristotle's brilliant emphasis on literature dealing in universals and being more philosophical, which involves the need for types of characters to act according to necessity or probability, into a banal rule about not doing anything impossible or improbable or implausible. For instance, one classicist criticized, in the name of the rule of probability, a prince appearing on stage without his retinue. Such critics seem to have forgotten or ignored the fact that Aristotle said, as we have seen, that, quote, it may be impossible that there are people like those Zeuxis painted, but it is better so, unquote. Now, the famous French classicist playwright Pierre Corneille attempted to spread his wings somewhat and compose a work, Les Cid, without an eye on all of the rules. He was criticized for it. Here is Weinberg again describing or listing the questions that were asked critically of the play. Quote, first, moral considerations. Is it proper for Chimène to consent to a marriage with her father's murderer? Second, questions of truth and probability. Would a Spanish nobleman like Don Diego have so many men at his command? Would the port of Seville be left unguarded in times of war? Third, matters of decorum. Is it acceptable for a king to play a joke? Fourth, the handling of the unities. Can all these events really have taken place within 24 hours? Unquote. Corneille did not write another play for 4 years, and there is nearly universal agreement that he never again reached the literary heights of Les Cid. Victor Hugo, in his preface to Cromwell, wrote of this, quote, "But the custom officers of thought will cry, great geniuses have submitted to these rules which you spurn." Unfortunately, yes. But what would those admirable men have done if they had been left to themselves? At all events, they did not accept your chains without a struggle. You should have seen how Pierre Corneille, worried and harassed at his first steps in art on account of his marvelous work, Les Cid, struggled under the critics of the Academy, how he denounced to posterity the violent attacks of those men who, he says, made themselves all white with Aristotle, unquote. A few lines later, Hugo sarcastically praises the way one critic, quote, crushes Corneille in the name of Aristotle, unquote. As an indication of just how perverted this is, I mean a perversion of Aristotle, note what Aristotle in fact said about art that presents what is impossible or implausible or erroneous. In Poetics 25, Aristotle discusses how to respond to criticisms of Homer. There were the same kind of mediocrities taking shots at Homer in Aristotle's day as there were, you know, taking these French academics who were criticizing Corneille. And Aristotle has strategies for how to solve Homeric problems, as it's put. He begins by making four recommendations concerning how to reply to the criticisms involving the art itself and what is represented. And here I'm going to go through these because I think it's instructive. Because all of this was, I think, passed over by the classicists who claimed Aristotle as their own. To the objection that the people portrayed are not true to life, Aristotle says that one may reply that the artist is presenting things not as they are, but as they ought to be. Quote, even as Sophocles said, he himself portrayed people such as they ought to be, Euripides as they are, unquote. And we saw that passage earlier. To the objection that what is portrayed is erroneous, and he has in mind here factual errors, and this is where pettifogging really comes into play, one may reply by pointing out that the error is incidental to the art itself, for example, to epic or painting, even though it is an error according to some other discipline, like biology. Aristotle gives as an example a painter erroneously portraying a female deer with horns, or presenting a jumping horse with the legs in a position which a jumping horse doesn't really have. That might be an error in biology, but it does not constitute a legitimate aesthetic criticism of a painting. It's just not significant enough. In my book on Aristotle's Lost Homeric Problems, I argue based on fragmentary evidence that there was almost certainly criticism and debate in which Aristotle participated over the age of Argos, Odysseus's dog. It's a wonderful scene in Odyssey 17. Here you have when Odysseus left to fight in Troy, it was just a puppy. And he returns 20 years, when Odysseus returns 20 years later and he's in disguise, Argos, the pup, is 20 years old and he's the only living being that recognizes Odysseus, and he swells with pleasure and then dies. What would a legitimate aesthetic criticism of this wonderful scene be? Dogs don't live 20 years. And that actually happened. There were people taking these shots at a genius work. And Aristotle discusses this scene, and I think there's no question that he would have responded that whatever the biological fact, and he knew a lot about the longevity of dogs. You can consult his Historia Animalium. This would not be a legitimate aesthetic criticism. To the charge that what is portrayed is false, not just piddly errors, but blatantly false, right? One may reply, Aristotle says, that even so, people believe that it is true. Aristotle gives as an example the traditional Olympian gods, which populate Homeric epic, lyric poetry, and classical drama. Even if Xenophanes is right, and he is, Aristotle says, and there are no such gods, and they don't exist, this is not grounds for criticizing Homer and the other poets, as most people do believe in such gods. So their appearance in a play doesn't do anything that makes the play unintelligible or a great aesthetic work. Finally, and this one is most relevant, contra the rule of probability, to the charge that what is portrayed is impossible, one may reply that though this would in most cases be an error, it is permissible, quote, if it achieves the end of the art itself, unquote. And Aristotle gives as an example the pursuit of Hector. That was the name the ancients gave to a scene in Iliad 22, where Achilles chases Hector around the walls of Troy three times, right? Not very likely that this could happen. Elsewhere in the Poetics, Aristotle gives this scene as an example of what is illogical or implausible. And he says that on stage, in a tragic play, this would be ludicrous. It would be the product of comedy, you know, running. But in epic, you can get away with this because it's conceptual. You're telling a story. It works in epic. In fact, he says the scene is marvelous. Victor Hugo, at the very end of his preface to Cromwell, quotes a loose French translation of this passage I just cited about the propriety of the impossible in order to use Aristotle against those who claimed him as their champion, against the classicists. And then he says, and this is the very end of his, I mean, so he's very aware that Aristotle is their hero. This is the very end of his preface to Cromwell. He writes, quote, after quoting this passage, quote, who said this? Aristotle. You will see that the author of this drama might as well as another have shielded himself with proper names and taken refuge behind others' reputations. But he preferred to leave that style of argument to those who deem it unanswerable, universal, and all-powerful. As for himself, he prefers reasons to authorities. He has always cared more for arms than for coats of arms. Unquote. That gives me chills every time. Romantic artists have never been all that concerned with avoiding impossibility and error concerning the minutest factual detail, whereas classicists and later naturalists have been and are. Romantic authors want a logical, coherent, plausible plot presenting out of the ordinary human beings doing great things, and that is something quite different, right? For Victor Hugo, it would not have mattered in the least if a human being, however strong, could not, in fact, achieve what he did, what Jean Valjean did, Paris sewer, lifting Marius above his head and walking through sewage as far as he did. Wouldn't have cared. It would not have mattered to Edmond Rostand had someone pointed out to him that there has never been in human history a nose as large as Cyrano's. Wouldn't have mattered. It did not matter to Alfred Hitchcock that there is no Frank Lloyd Wright-style house behind the heads of Mount Rushmore in North by Northwest. The story required it, so there it was, right? Ayn Rand recognized that it was impossible that Galt Strike could succeed in the time it does in Atlas Shrugged. And to point that out would not constitute a legitimate aesthetic critique. And it does not make Atlas Shrugged any less a work of romantic realism, as she uses that designation. She makes this point emphatically in answer to a letter from Gerald Loeb concerning The Fountainhead, and particularly the criticism that it is purportedly unrealistic. This is a 1944 letter. And I was very pleased to learn today that there are even more letters appearing of Ayn Rand, and I think the first set of these are on the app. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong about that. In any event, this is from a 1944 letter, and she writes, quote, don't ever, ever think that you must write only of things which literally happened, and that if you do, your writing will be good. This, all caps, is the foremost sign of the amateur, unquote. And a bit later she adds, quote, there is a story told about Michelangelo which illustrates this beautifully. On one of his statues, that of David, I believe, he made a muscle which never existed on a real human body. When he was told that nature never created such a muscle, he answered that nature should have. That is a true artist, unquote. So on this issue, Aristotle and the Romantics were clearly on the same side, contrary to the classicists. Now let me wrap up. In the afterword to Atlas Shrugged about the author, Ayn Rand claimed that, quote, "The only philosophical debt I can acknowledge is to Aristotle. I most emphatically disagree with a great many parts of his philosophy, but his definition of the laws of logic and of the means of human knowledge is so great an achievement that his errors are irrelevant by comparison," unquote. And in her review of John Herman Randall's Aristotle, she wrote that, quote, "If there is a philosophical atlas who carries the whole of Western civilization on his shoulders, it is Aristotle. He has been opposed, misinterpreted, misrepresented, and, like an axiom, used by his enemies in the very act of denying him. Whatever intellectual progress men have achieved rests on his achievements," unquote. What I find so fascinating about my subject today is that these claims apply to Aristotle's aesthetics as well, though that is not what Ayn Rand had in mind when she wrote them. Aristotle's might be and ought to be principle is, so far as I know, the only debt she acknowledged in connection with her philosophy of art. Aristotle's aesthetics was opposed, misinterpreted, misrepresented, and used by his enemies in the very act of denying him, or worse, in a way, misused by his supposed advocates in the very act of defending him. Finally, the idea of Aristotle as Atlas applies in some small way, I think, to his literary aesthetics and its influence. And I hope I've made that clear today. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, I have a question about the classicists. They used Aristotle and misrepresented him clearly, but yet they still used him, so they still found some value in him. So why did they use him and not someone like Plato? What was so special about Aristotle to them?
That's a good question. First of all, Aristotle was a major force in the universities, and it was only in the Renaissance to some extent, but in the modern period too, where they were beginning to reject the scholastic philosophy, which was based on Aristotle. So he was a big name, and if you could claim him as your own, that was really something. But it's the part of the point that Hugo makes, that they prefer coats of arms to arms, that is, authorities to arguments. But it wasn't just Aristotle was the main name, but they also, it was very weird, it was more complex than I may have suggested. They took principles from Horace. Horace wrote in The Art of Poetics, and they took it from Aristotle, and they mashed them together, and they called it Aristotelian. But it was the authority of the name Aristotle, right? In the Renaissance, Plato starts to take on a greater influence in certain circles, but not in aesthetics, and partly because, or at least not in the aesthetics of literature, partly because he's so negative about, he thinks Homer should be banished from the best city of the Republic. What kind of art should there be not representational art? Hymns and encomia, the praise of, in verse to heroes and gods, but not this representational stuff. So that's why they grabbed onto Aristotle. You are right. Maybe they genuinely or honestly thought that there were great things there that they were making use of too.
Okay.
Yes, I was wondering if you could comment on Aristotle's influence on Wordsworth and Coleridge and the English Romantic movement, because when they talk about imagination as a kind of a unity, I don't know if they've read a lot of Aristotle, but it sounds like what you're talking about.
I have to confess ignorance here. I'm not sure about any influence. The only thing I know is Coleridge once said, and it's a brilliant line, that every person is born a Platonist or an Aristotelian. And he had a certain view of what that meant, but I don't know about their views of literature. I know there's books that have been written on English classicism in particular, and they have a slightly different use of Aristotle, but I really can't help you out, I'm sorry.
Do you think that Aristotle's discussion of art, especially his discussion of harmartia, gives us a greater glimpse into the romantic possibilities of ancient Greek art? Because harmartia is not a tragic flaw, but a missing of the mark by a morally decent person, and on Aristotle's view, specifically due to forgivable ignorance, which you'd need to read his Ethics to really give some flesh to.
Well, you're packing a definite interpretation of hamartia, the Greek word for that's usually translated error or flaw. In the New Testament, it becomes sin. Your interpretation, and it's a good one. I mean, I think it might be one that is in fact correct. That there's no tragic flaw. These are mistakes that are not, because the word, the Greek word can mean, it can refer to a moral breach, but it can also refer to a mistake. And one interpretation is that there's no tragic flaw in Aristotle. There are, so the question would be in interpreting Aristotle on Oedipus, did Oedipus just have an unfortunate lack of information and that drove the play? Or is there something in his character? I wouldn't call it a flaw, but you could say a moral failing, despite being a great person in many ways, a moral failing, pride or, you know, this, or stubbornness or whatever, that generated the action. So I can't say more than that. It's interesting, though, that, we'd have to pursue that. You'd have to say that Aristotle's conception of hamartia is based on a view of human beings as volitional, right? Yeah, yes. And that one could use that and then you could relate that to the Romantic movement, at least as Ayn Rand articulates it. I mean, the core essence of Romanticism, in her view, is it's the school of literature that respects human volition, that relies on it. And if that's true, but we're talking now not about what might happen, but what could happen or what did happen. What did happen is they didn't read Aristotle that way, right? When you say the classicists didn't, and the romanticists didn't. When Hugo refers to Aristotle at the end, I don't think he's reinterpreting that
Oh, no, I wasn't referring to the classicists. I'm just referring to our reading Aristotle is giving us a glimpse into ancient Greek art, broadly construed, as actually having more romantic possibilities than we might assume. It just looks like this deterministic universe, but Aristotle's discussion of it opens up the possibility of volition.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. That I think that's right, and I think you have to read each of these plays carefully, because some of them are... I mean, there's an obvious contradiction. For it to make any sense at all, the play has to have at least assume a certain amount of volition, right? A certain amount of action. But there's a giant contradiction there. In Aeschylus's Agamemnon, the chorus says, you know, simultaneously, he was yoked to necessity. He had to do what he did to his daughter Iphigenia. And it was a morally abysmal act. And that's just, they're embracing that contradiction. But I think you're right. I see Antigone as, whatever Sophocles, however he would have articulated or Aristotle would have articulated, I see her as a volitional being. And I read the play that way, and it makes it a better play.
Thank you.
I've been told that Aristotle said that tragedies are written at times of moral upheaval or moral change. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to make a lot of sense. There was Greek tragedy, there was tragedies written in the Renaissance, and teenagers are very often filled with angst at times when they're selecting their own moral code and rejecting the one they were raised with. So I was wondering, is that true, and could you comment on that?
I don't know that he said that. Nothing's coming to mind. The Greek word tragedy, it's related to the word for goat. It has something, you know, tragedy is not necessarily having a tragic ending, if that doesn't, you know, make sense. That is, there are Greek plays that the wonderful Oresteia ends on a high note. One of Euripides' Iphigenia plays has a happy ending. The Helen is not tragic. Euripides' Helen is not. So tragic, the difference between tragedy and comedy for the ancient Greeks, tragedy is serious in tone. Comedy is ludicrous. It makes fun of people and stuff like that. Now, why do so many of the tragedies in the ancient sense have tragic endings in our sense? I think the world was, if you're in Athens, for example, in ancient Greece, if you go to war, there was no military. I mean, that appears in the Roman period, I guess, but in the Greek world, the military was men between the ages of, who were citizens of Athens, say, between the ages of 18 and 30, 16 and 35, 14, you know, depending on how serious it got. And if you lost a battle, the men were killed, the children were taken off to Persia or something like that. This guy's farm over here is destroyed in famine, this one's okay. There's a sense, you could see why people would have a malevolent view of the universe in that context, and why things are not entirely in their control. And I think that's what, I haven't much given it much thought as far as times of upheaval, but I think it's understandable that that these plays abound in this period where it's just taking off. I don't know enough about, I think Renaissance tragedy, as I understand it, is tragic in a different kind of way. But maybe not, but I don't have anything to add there.
I'm fascinated by your idea of stylized naturalism. Can you say some more about that?
Did I say stylized naturalism? I thought when I was quoting Ayn Rand, I think she said that that Greek sculpture is idealized naturalism or beautiful naturalism, so it's like the selection comes in the subject matter. I'm going to pick beefy guys who, you know, do push-ups and all that, and they're nice looking, and they're going to be the subject of my sculpture, but they're not stylized to present an individual artist's value judgment. That's what she says about ancient Greek sculpture, and I think that's going to be the key to people who want to do work in expanding kind of aesthetics, romantic aesthetics. It's going to have something to do with the stylization in a way that presents an individual artist's value judgments. She's done the work in Romanticism. But what it's not going to involve, of course, is just taking, I have these objectivist convictions and presenting them on canvas in a way that's not, you know, reflecting of your own individual personal values. But did you have something else in mind that you wanted to talk about? All right. I guess we'll end there. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.